Welcome to the June 16th version of Public Works Advisory Board for the City of Morro Bay. Please note that there are four of five members present, and with Bill Olson not being able to attend. If we could start off the meeting with a moment of silence. Moving on, could I have a motion to accept the agenda from last, the acceptance of the meeting of the agenda? So we'll make that. And a second. And all those in favor? Okay. And we move on to announcements. PWAB is usually made up of seven members, and just recently we've had two members retire, John Sweemer. And Susan Shaw, and although they're not with us, we'd like to say thank you for their time that they were on the board. And second, we have written communications, and although we're going to listen, we have one from the Citizen Bike Committee, but they're going to be doing a presentation, so we'll just talk about that later. Going on to public comments, presentations. There's going to be a change in the agenda. Folks saw it on the screen. Bicycle empowerment presentation was going to go first, but if they don't mind, we're going to move up the tree committee to speak first. And with that said, here we go.
Hello, I'm Taylor Newton, a member of the Citizens Tree Committee here from Morro Bay. I'm also a Morro Bay resident and a Morro Bay business owner. And this is our new and revised master tree list, and also the supplementary complementary street tree list. And basically what we did, we changed, made a number of changes to what we presented to you last time. If you all remember, we presented this once already. And basically, what this is a start. And so it doesn't have to be a final draft. We can make changes to this. And really what we're going for today is for me to present to you the format and this new list, and to answer questions and kind of get your feedback on it and then pass it on or rework it and bring it back to you. So, what I want to start with is that the cover sheet that I wrote up for you guys basically explains what we're trying to get at with this new updated master tree list for the City of Morro Bay. And the idea is that we have one master tree list for the City of Morro Bay, and what that list is a list of trees that our city staff plants on our public property, as well as trees that citizens can go into the city hall or wherever this list is and get a copy of this list, and those trees on the list are trees that grow well in this area. So that's the main two purposes of the list. We all thought that the old list was too old, and that things have changed since in the last 30 years. Mostly the changes that I'm speaking upon is that we are now more concerned about the trees we plant having fiscal costs as far as maintenance and damage to our public property, and also there's a general consensus throughout California and hopefully throughout the world that we should lean towards planting trees and plants that grow in this area naturally. You know, why plant trees throughout the city that aren't trees that grow in California? You know, why plant all Australian trees and not plant California trees? That doesn't seem logical. That being said, we did keep a number of trees from the old list because they were on the old list. You plant the wrong tree on a city street, it's going to end up costing a lot of money in damage to sidewalks, in maintenance, and in debris and possible, you know, someone slipping on the seed pods of eucalyptus could be a problem with them suing the city for not having clean sidewalks, for example. So the street tree list, of all the lists, I think that's the most important, because if you plant the wrong tree, it costs you a lot of money, and that's taxpayers' dollars. So the master tree list, we have basically at the top, you have six criteria. Each of these trees on this list meet at least two of those criteria. I could have listed next to each tree what of those criteria are, and that would be for you to help you understand it. But the final draft, I don't think should have that on there. After each tree, I don't think it's necessary to list, you know, Acer, palmatum, Japanese maple, just to start it off, for example. The two criteria on this list above that, of the six criteria, that it would meet, would be trees that have fruit or flower. The Acer palmatum doesn't have fruit, but it does have a flower, and its leaf structure is similar to a flower. It has autumn color, so there's a beauty portion to that. That is a criteria. It meets that criteria. Now, it's kind of a, that's a great example, because it's not native to California, but our native maple doesn't really grow well in the areas of Morro Bay. And the maple is such a great tree for certain spots where there is water, like in a lawn. That would be a shame not to have a representative of the maple group. So we had that on there. But that's also a great example of a tree that wasn't on the last list that we added that could be taken off. It doesn't have to be on there. And there are trees on here that don't need to be on the master tree list. Although we on the tree committee, these are the best trees we've come up with. So that's our suggestion. Does that make sense with the criteria, how the criteria work? Now, when you get to the sublists, this first sublist being the street tree list, it's much more important that they meet those criteria because they're for specific use. The sublist, street tree list, those trees on that list need to meet more of those criteria because they're for a specific use. So, on the six criteria, of the six criteria listed here at the top of your street tree list, each of these trees meet at least four of those criteria. For example, the first one, strawberry madrone, Arbutus marina, which we've been planting a lot of in the last year, replacing our old trees that have been coming down along the city streets. The criteria that it meets would be minimal root damage to hardscape. It's supposed to have deep roots, like down deep in the soil instead of being on the surface. If you have roots that are growing on the surface, it's going to push your sidewalks up, thus costing you money to either repair those sidewalks or replace those sidewalks. California Central Coast native naturalized. That word naturalized we use because they might not have originally been here, but now they grow here very well and compete with the other natives. Because the strawberry madrone is actually a hybrid. It's not man has created that plant, although it is somewhat a native. Do you understand? Those are two criteria. Let's see the other criteria. Minimal root damage, minimal water irrigation requirements. That would be, of all these trees, everything, you know, except for some of the ones on the master tree list that are going to be for, like, gray water use, when you're trying to recycle your gray water, obviously the trees you plant around a gray water system would be trees that want water. That's what you're using it for. So that sublist would list that in its criteria. We haven't made that sublist yet. We're going to have you guys approve these trees on the master tree list before we put the time in to create the rest of the sublist. Again, the most important sublist is the street tree list, which we've already created for you. Onward, a couple of trees on the master tree list that we have thought about changing and maybe not keeping on there. We listed 6 pines. The reason we listed so many pines is we have a historical value. Pines have been planted in this area for at least 100 years. We have a street in Morro Bay called Piney because the number of pines that were planted on that street. So you can see why we'd want to have pines be on the master tree list. But at the same time, a number of those pines, specifically the Monterey pine, almost always gets disease and dies. So that might be a good example of a tree that we would not want to keep on there, even though the Monterey pine is our only pine that really is our native pine for the area. That would be the reason I put it on there. I think the argument for taking it off being that if you plant it and it gets disease and causes you all kinds of problems, I think that argument outweighs the argument that it is our native pine. They didn't do very well. In 30 years, they've only got a trunk maybe eight inches in diameter, which really, you know, isn't very much for 30 years of growth. Even though it isn't a tree that ever gets really big, it doesn't necessarily need to be on the list. There's not a good argument to keep it on there. But we did keep a number of Melaleuca, a number of eucalyptus, and some other trees that were from the old list that aren't native, that have many reasons why maybe they shouldn't be planted, but they have been planted, and there isn't a good enough argument to just get rid of them altogether. The street tree list is a really good example of what the other sub-lists are going to be like. The other sub-lists being, the first one's the city street tree list, the second one, open space and parks list, and that would be our open spaces and our parks, the trees you plant in there. And then the third list was private residence and gray water reclamation list. Now, those sublists, if you were to divide all the trees between those sublists, that would be all the trees in the master tree list. Does that make sense? And like I said, each sublist will, your criteria at the top of that sublist will be more specific, therefore defining what the use of that tree is. And then, the last thing that we're going to want to do is after we've completed the next two sublists, we want to have a complementary key to go with those sublists, where the person planting them, be it staff or a citizen of Morro Bay, not only do they have this very simple list that's easy to read, but then they have a complementary key. So if the person's going, I want to plant a tree in my front yard, in my lawn, well, they could go to, you know, they could probably pull a tree off of any of these lists and it would work for that situation. But specifically, I would suggest to them to go to the private residence and gray water reclamation list and find a tree on that list, because those trees are specific for using lots of water and so on. And that list would have a complimentary key with pictures and more information on that specific tree and its specific use and the concerns that you might have with it. Concerns. That's another good point to be made. Trees like the California fan palm, which we have listed on our city street tree list. Now, a lot of people in California think about California trees and they say, you know, palm trees. You know, a lot of people think California has palm trees, especially people that aren't from California. Our only native palm for California would be the California fan palm. And that palm's really only native to desert climates, and they grow in a desert where there is a water source, like an oasis. I don't know if you'd call it an oasis down in the Mojave Desert, but there's a small water source in the desert, and that's where that tree is natively growing. Now, when you plant it here in town, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to do great, but it is a palm tree, and the Mexican fan palm and the California fan palm, basically all the palms in Morro Bay, besides the Canary Island fan palm, are either a California fan palm or a Mexican fan palm. The Canary Island fan palm is the really big palms, specifically the one, there's a 100-year-old one at the old post office right across from the Bank of America. Those three trees are Canary Island fan palms. And we didn't keep those on the street tree list because they get a little too big to be on the street. And you can see if you go and looked at those trees how they might be too big on the sidewalk, taking too much room on the sidewalk. Where a Mexican fan palm or a California fan palm, which grow much narrower in trunk circumference, are a better use on the street. At the same time, in your key for this sublist, you would want to have a note saying, if you were to plant a California fan palm, you need to be concerned about these things. And, you know, trees that are on these lists that have concerns that have maybe an equally valuable debate on either side of why we should plant it or why we shouldn't plant it, those trees in your complementary key would have those concerns. And that's where you would find that information. So basically, the format of this list and the trees in the master tree list, this is kind of our final draft. The trees in the master tree list are what we think should be on the master tree list, besides maybe taking off the Monterey pine. I think of all those trees, taking off the Monterey pine is probably the one thing I would agree with. The format of being very simple, where you only have a common name and a scientific name, makes it very easy to read and not so confusing for a person who isn't a biologist or an arborist. Having all your criteria at the top makes it very easy to understand, very simple, and easy to make copies of and distribute or have on a web page. That format is our final draft format. So, you know, the format of this list and the trees that we do have on the master tree, minimal water needs. Over here on the master tree list, we don't have a criteria that says minimal water needs, but we do have a criteria, number two, that says trees that are native to California. Most trees that are native to California are drought tolerant. Now, if there was a native tree to California that wasn't drought tolerant, it probably isn't on this list because it probably doesn't do well in this area because we don't have a lot of water. Unless it was on, if it was intended to be on the private residence and graywater reclamation list, sublist, you could have a California native that needs water on that list. But most likely, every tree on the master tree list shouldn't need a lot of water. You are going to be able to make an argument against that for some trees, like the California fan palm again. Although in its, after 5 years, those trees really shouldn't need water. They should be able to put their roots deep enough to find their own water source. The first 5 years, you really do need to water them or they're going to look kind of haggard. For example, we planted about six or eight of those on the street to replace eucalyptuses that died in the last 2 months. And they all look a little haggard, even though they have been watered fairly well. And that's just the way it is. You know, they need to be watered once a week for the first 2 years and once every 2 weeks for the first 5 years. And then after that, they should be fine. But those are the kind of things that you could have in your complimentary information part of that sublist that would tell you those things. You know, when someone, a hotel is asked, you have 5 vacant street tree wells, what tree do you want planted here? And they go to the street tree list and they say, we want to plant all palms. Well, then we would say, well, read the information that complements that and says, California fan palms need water once a week for the first 3 years. California fan palms can get scale disease pest problems if overwater or given too much nitrogen fertilizer or are in a very humid area where a lot of plant growth is around them, creating an environment where there isn't a lot of air circulation. Those would be the kind of conditions that would allow for a pest to come in and bother that plant. And that information would be available complementing that sublist. And I can't think of anything else at any time. What do you think?
All right, Taylor. That was a bit different from the last one. I appreciate all the work you've done.
Well, it's not just me.
No. I, when I say you, I mean collectively, yeah. the tree committee. I had one. So I guess once this is finished, we can then post this on the Public Works page of the city's website, I would think. People would be able to access that. I mean, I'm looking down the road because, it's not okay yet, but if they go to a PDF form, if someone wanted to download it, we could do that.
Once the Planning Commission has approved it per our code, it requires Planning Commission approval to modify this master tree list. So once it's approved by Planning Commission, then we would make it available on our website, put it in our engineering standards for those to use. Until then, we could use it as a guidance document because there are provisions in our existing tree ordinance that allow basically any tree for a good reason to be planted, even if it's not on our master tree list.
Here, I had one more. Morro Bay is not, maybe this is a I guess this goes here. Would an explanation of the various microclimates in Morro Bay be appropriate too?
You could. I feel like any information we add to this list complicates it. So the information you do add should be very valuable. Now, by dividing it into these sublists, like you have one master tree list, which is, covers all the sublists. Now, by separating it into sublists, which are more user-friendly, that allows you to, you know, you could list microclimates for each sublist. You know, the trees that are on the street tree list are only a, really will do well in certain microclimates, and the trees that are going to be on the open space and parks list would be specific for certain microclimates. I don't necessarily think that's necessary because the amount of information you need to define a microclimate is pretty extensive. Because when you start, you know, calling something a microclimate, you, there's really no limit to how far you can go down. You know, you could have a 6-foot microclimate and it could be different 6 feet away just depending on the wind and the, your water runoff and what plants are already growing there. You know, that kind of stuff changes it. So it's important to not add too much information because that will basically create the problem we had before where you had a list that's not user-friendly. You know, a lot of citizens didn't understand how to use the last list. And I felt that some of the staff, you know, even were like, well, these are the trees we're planting. You know, that list has kind of got a whole bunch of trees that I don't even know what they are. I mean, I have a degree in biology, specific that water going down to our water treatment plant or into our groundwater. And then so you would need to know the right kind of tree or plant to be planted there to use that water. You wouldn't want to have a tree planted there that couldn't take that extra nitrogen that is in your gray water. You know, basically, the water that comes out of your washing machine or out of your sink after you wash your hands and stuff is a lightly fertilized water. So you need to have trees that can take that water and use those nutrients.
Okay.
Without getting sick.
And then my, okay.
Like the bamboo. Like the bamboo is a great example. I would not have had the bamboo on there at all.
The but, clumping timber bamboo?
Yeah, the mm-hmm. old hamii. But, you know, that is a tree that can use gray water. So that would be, I couldn't imagine planting that plant anywhere else in town unless it was planted in an area where there was a constant supply of water, which would be like a gray water use.
Cool. And then my other question is about the key, highly anticipated complementary key.
Yes.
You said that it would be, will this be listed by, maybe we can set it up in the first place properly. Is it being set up by name of plant or by category?
So basically, the sublist, you have an example here, the street tree sublist. That's our first one we've made for you. Now, the key that goes along with this would basically follow the same format as this. You would have, you know, you started off Arbutus marina. You'd have Arbutus marina, a picture of it maybe, where it's from, its origin, its uses, and its concerns. And that would be your key. And that would be much more of a, you know, that's not a it's not required for what we're trying to do here, but I think that that allows us to get the people more involved with the landscape that is around them. And that's really a big part of the goal of all this, is we would like to see the people of our city more involved with the environment around them, specifically the plants and trees, because it's one of our hugest resources, maybe our most important.
I totally agree with you. And as someone who is trying to select a tree right now for my backyard, I would really appreciate being able to open up the key and say, look for drought tolerant.
Okay.
And all these are drought tolerant. Flowering, boom. All these ones are, they might be cross-referenced. They might be on multiple lists. And I will, currently. Okay, yeah, that sort of thing for the new list. If it's going to be web-based, it would be great to be able to, you know, somehow, I don't know, click on the numbers and pull up the name, the lists, but
that
to have it be driven by There are many people who love birds in this community, fruiting trees or butterfly trees or...
The complementary key, really, it's going to be a very broad thing where we can have it be anything we want, and we can change it all the time. And I think that it really gives us an opportunity to not only... Could you click on a tree and maybe have an example of where in the city you could see one, you know? And it also gives us the opportunity to tie into our history. Maybe that key also ties into our historical walk or even our...
That was my next question.
You know, you can tie all those things together with that key, and that's the intention eventually. Go ahead, Walt.
It's been going on for 15 years. I guess some of you know that. The first tree list was available 15 years ago, and then we have another tree list available 10 years ago. And I've been involved with all of them. In the 10-year list, we had the flower and the drought-resistant and the height and all that junk. That's fine, and that's great. It's available. This last list is a summary of everything. It's 20 trees. That first list, 15 years ago, we had 100 trees. 10 years ago, we had 65 trees. Now we have 20 trees on our master tree list, recommended, and basically the drought resistant from Australia. That's all we show. It's just genus and species. Now, if you want to get verbose, we can get back into that list, but we get criticized for whatever we do. So it's kind of hard to come up with one list that meets everybody. Now this list is supposed to be for the city, just 20. Now this other list he has. These guys have done an outstanding job, the new young people who followed this new list. They've got a little bit of everything in here, and it's about 65 trees, and they've got color, and they've got all these criteria. So I think it's very positive. You can take it from an old guy that we've got this stuff in the yard maintenance, and if the people want it, it's still available. However, it's a little bit more verbose, and there's more trees involved. And they've got it. It tells you what kind of flower and the wildlife. This other list, this sub-list, we can still come up with that.
Yeah, I was asking mostly about the key, and I certainly hope my comment didn't sound like criticism. I'm delighted. I'm actually, for the first time, feeling inspired enough and empowered enough to make my selection, perhaps. So thank you.
Yeah, I think that the idea of having... being able to divide the master tree list into sub-lists really makes it user-friendly, because... You have three sublists, and you go to the top of those sublists, and there's six criteria that explain define the trees on that sublist. So it's very quickly, like, you know, you could go to those three sublists, and you read the top six criteria, and you think to yourself, well, I'm looking for a tree that needs water. The first thing on this city street tree list is minimal water. Well, I want a tree that can take a lot of water. So you don't look at that sublist. You go to the next sublist. And that way... It really makes it simple for you to find the right tree, and then the complementary key that you'll eventually have complementing each sublist will give you all the information that you could take maybe two or three times the amount of time to go onto the internet or go into a taxonomic key and find that information for yourself. And the point of doing that is, like I said, is really to, you know, the goal is to really get people more involved with our city and the history of our environment and the future of our environment, because... That's really where the money's at, I think. As well as, you know, the heart of, you know, our city, is our natural resources. Any more questions?
Sure. Just wanted to clarify one. First of all, I want to say this is a great list. You did a lot of work. I really, really like the format of having one simple list and then breaking it down into the subcategories and then having further detail in the individual tree list. That you're going to do, I think you're covering all the bases that way. I think that's really great. And that you're giving the criteria of how each tree ends up on the list. I think that could be in the details of each tree when you go to it, you know, which criteria it met. Anyway, I think overall it's a great layout, a great plan. One of the questions I just wanted to clarify for myself and maybe other people that are listening is this master tree list is really recommendations to the public. From what the city's perspective is. People can still plant any tree they want that they can go to the nursery and buy and put in their yard. It's not going to be illegal or anything, correct? I mean,
correct.
It's just really trees that have been found through your group's research and experience that work well in the city. Every tree on here will work well, and it should be in the right application.
Yes.
Which is what the sublist is about.
On private property, anybody can plant anything they want.
Right. Okay.
But on public property, like, for example, it's a really good example, when the guy that has, it was Tokyo Joe's Sushi, now it's Osaka Joe's Sushi, when he was coming up, getting that business put in, he wanted to plant trees on the sidewalk in front of the sushi shop. But there was some debate if that was, if he needed to, if he could choose any tree he wanted, or if he needed to do a tree off of the tree list. And he ended up coming to the conclusion that it needed to be off the tree list. So he wanted to plant a maple. And the maple that was on the tree list was not going to do well there. And so I said to him, why don't you plant a Japanese maple? Because of all the maples, even though it's not native, I, from experience, seeing that planted in San Luis Obispo, seeing it planted here in Morro Bay, of all the maples, I think that's your best shot for it looking good and doing well. And that would be an example of a private use of this list. It, you know, it was his property, but it was right there on the street, so that's why he was using this list. And you can see how, even though it was private use, he still wanted to use it off this public list. But, you know, on someone's home, you can plant anything you want.
Right. But the city would try to limit its choices as far as street trees, public trees, to the list that
that's
the sublist.
The only thing that I'm really adamant about is this street tree list is really important because it costs us money to repair the damage from the trees on our streets. All this work we did on our sidewalks this last year cost, I mean, how much money did that cost?
The sidewalk grinding cost about $22,000.
Wow.
You know, and if you had planted trees that didn't pop the sidewalk up, there's $22,000 we could have saved. I mean, I'm sure there's still going to need to be money spent on maintenance and repairs and stuff. I mean, it's going to drop branches. They're a living organism. They live and they die and they get sick. But, you know, with proper maintenance and the correct tree planted in the correct spot, you should minimize wasteful spending.
I have another comment that hasn't come up so far, but you did note in the cover letter that this list is not set in stone. It's flexible, and you recommend that at least every 10 years that it be updated again. It's been 30 years, I understand, since I thought that's what you'd said.
I thought it was 30 years, but I think, like Wally said, there has been some updates. Uh-huh. And I put on this cover letter that, in my opinion, this list should be reviewed and updated at least once a decade because, I mean, I'm new to it. This is my first year on it, and I think we've done some really great things. And, you know, we're all – anybody can be on the tree committee. It's totally volunteer. No one's voted on there. It's all just concerned citizens working for the benefit of our local environment.
Well, question I have.
I don't know. We've been talking on the city tree committee about, we do have a city website, the Morro Bay city website, and on that website it'd be neat if we had like a, well, I thought we should have a tree committee page on that website that listed all kinds of stuff with the tree committee, like the new landmark tree ordinance that hopefully should be official soon. The possibility of a, you know, we have a city flower, but we don't have a city tree. Why not? That's something that's you're gonna find out if we're gonna be talking about in the next few months. There should be a city tree, you know, a city tree list. People should know about it. People should, you know, if they go on the website and they click on the city tree committee, because there the word tree is right there, and there's our list of the master tree list. You know, I think that is very useful and very helpful.
May I jump in and say, at a bare minimum, I would recommend that all the nurseries in the area, in the county, be provided with at least one copy, a master copy for their desk.
Nurseries in Morro Bay.
At the very least.
Well, and
yeah.
City Hall will have this information available at no charge, right?
Right. The current mm-hmm. master tree list is still available at City Hall, correct, Rob?
Yes. And it's also on our website. The tree list is on our website. And as we revise and adopt this tree list, it'll replace that master street tree list that is on our website. So,
does it have to be approved by city council, or is it just the planning commission?
I believe it's just the planning commission.
Oh.
As some of you know, 200 years ago, I'm a landscape architect. I had to do a plan for somebody, developer in town, and the Coastal Commission wanted us to do what was native 200 years ago. There's only about three or four trees that were native in this area 200 years ago. It's very difficult. Even the Monterey pine, we're stretching it to say it's native in this area. The bald cypress was native 10 million years ago before the Ice Age. So it depends what you say, California native, what's native. But what we're doing is trying to help with the drought resistance of plants. This is our main interest. It depends what section or what decade you're going to plan for. But we can come up with different lists for different areas, which is what each is trying to say.
Yeah, and just also another note on dissemination of this information. I would think that all the landscape architects and gardeners and landscape designers, all those guys should be...
It was the same guys 10 years ago. All of them, Cal Poly, and this guy has a master's degree in something, I don't know what it is, but we had all these people, and they came up with a good list. Now we have no buildings. And as I said 200 years ago, we only had four trees, so I'm going to get one tree.
Yeah, a good point to make is that I bet if you went through all these trees in the master tree list and went back 100 years, I don't know if any of them would have been. I think that when you look at Morro Bay, you got to remember that almost all the trees we have here are here because of the people that are here or work. So that's another good point to make, that the trees we do have, like the blue gum eucalyptus, the red flowering eucalyptus, even though we have a lot of arguments why they aren't good trees to plant in the area, there's just as many arguments why they are. They do have value. I would say your best argument is historical or cultural heritage. And that was another point. Some of the trees are on here because of agricultural use in our history or in our current use, like the avocado or the citrus. We have a ton of avocado grown in our area. We have a ton of citrus grown in our area. We should suggest that as a tree to be planted in the parks. I mean, why plant a pine tree in the middle of a park where kids play when you could plant an avocado tree or a citrus tree that looks just as pretty and maybe has a functional use that they could pick up fruit, tear apart, or even eat? And it should be on the list, and that's why it is on the list.
I really like the approach of wanting to get people more involved in their landscaping and their plants around them. I think that's a great concept to be following. And I the other thing that I think really does need to be seriously considered always, and I think you do, is the drought tolerance. Because as we talked about with palms, they need a moderate amount of water, by most gardening books would say that. And then not after 5 years, but even after 5 years, the reason they don't need top watering.
I've always thought of California because we have palms, but a lot of people don't know that we really don't have any native palms. The California fan palm, like I said, isn't our only California native palm, but it's not native to our area at all. There was the argument that we shouldn't have palms on these lists at all. But I also got just as many arguments that said that is ludicrous. You know, palms are an important part of California. And I was going to make this note. We have the California fan palm and the Mexican fan palm on the street tree list. They're also on the master tree list alongside with the Canary Island date palm. And then there's another fan palm called the Guadalupe fan palm that might be another palm that could be added to the list as well. My question being, what do you think about having palms on the list?
I think it's part of our heritage. And when you see pictures of early California, you see beach streets, lined palm trees. You go over in the Central Valley, you'll see whole roadways with palm trees. Tall palm trees. So it's just something to have.
I think that a note as far as attractiveness of palms is that they look best when they are in a group. And when there's just a single palm by itself, especially the tall, narrow ones, I think they look kind of out of place when they're by themselves. And really, the other thing with palms is the view that most people are going to get of a palm is its trunk. Because if the head's 80 feet above us, we're not looking at that. We're walking in a parking lot, and all we see is this big, stocky thing with nothing really very attractive to look at, you know, taking a plot in the ground.
I'm not making a position for palms. I'm just saying that's part of our history.
Right.
And that's what we think of when we talk about California.
Right. And I'm not, they aren't my personal favorite, but that, but not that I get to decide what's on this list that way. There's room for everybody to have what they like on there. I guess I would just say that it would be nice if the recommendation could be made that palms, if they're planted in public ways, because you do have them on the street tree list, that maybe they're as a grouping. And that we try to, try to go to the, there are a couple on there that are less water needy, and that we try to go with those palms.
And those kind of things could be in that key part where it's like, you could, next to the California fan palm, it's the complementary key. It has those concerns, you know, like look better, traditionally look better, planted in, traditionally healthier, if not overwatered and over-fertilized. Things like that. Those, that's where you could have those notes and keep the tree on the list.
To me, the palm tree is sort of a Southern California thing, and I have a promotion that I'm trying to get going here in the city, that Morabe Boulevard is the official halfway point between Southern California and Northern California, and that possibly palm trees only be planted south of Morabe Boulevard and maybe Monterey Pines north of Morabe Boulevard to emphasize that idea.
I also have a suggestion about the way to distribute this material. Being new to the area, I knew of this until I came on this committee. And so the realtors I dealt with would have been helpful if I'd have gotten something from them saying there is such an item and how do I make access to it. I'm still working in my yard, but I've been, when you kept talking about this, I kept thinking, well, I've lived here over a year now. Until I came here, I had no idea this type of thing existed.
How about the newcomers packet?
Well, and I think it's a great idea, Richard. After we were first, everyone should be on the Public Works Advisory Board Committee at some point in their time, is what you're saying. And after we were presented with that landscaping your yard brochure, I went right over the next day to the Public Works Advisory Public Works Department and got a big stack of them. They're available for free at that office. And now every new buyer client, all realtors, grab those, and I give them now in my welcome to Morro Bay.
I can tell you that's a good idea.
Thank you.
The realtor I dealt with did not do that. And so I kept thinking, how would I ever know about this unless I was here?
So with that, Rob, what do we need to do? If we like this plan in its nascent form right now with the format, and Taylor, you're going to finish and flesh this out, do we just say that we like it and then send it on to the planning?
Yeah, you can make a motion that you approve the format and the content of the master tree and street tree list, and you recommend forwarding it up. You forward it on to Planning Commission and recommend their adoption.
And before we do that, would anybody like to see the finished version of it? When do you propose having that done, Taylor?
I could. If you like the way it is, the format and the content in a majority, it's not going to take me much time at all.
So then you could have a finished format with all the sub-list breakouts for the next PWAB meeting?
Yeah, we could do that.
You probably wouldn't mind if you had more time than a month, you know, to get it done.
I don't think we're having a tree committee meeting until August or September, so pretty much I don't have any projects to work on besides this. I was supposed to be working on this new city street. I mean, you're going to have a new project being the city tree proposal, but if we don't have a meeting, then I'm not going to be working on that. So I can do whatever you want with it, basically.
I'd like to have it come back to us again, but I don't want to put any strict time frames on you. I mean, when it fits in our agenda, unless you're in a hurry to get it done and get it onto the Planning Commission.
If there's not a lot of changes, then I can make those changes and send it to you and get your response before it goes to the Planning Commission and move it on straight onto the Planning Commission. But if there is a lot of changes, then I do think it needs to come back here and be discussed like we just discussed it. I think the way we just discussed this is very helpful for me. So much, I'm new to this. I'm new to coming forward and doing presentations to committees like this. And I thought the way this ran is really helpful.
Well, maybe we could be helpful a little bit on the other two sub-lists as well. Maybe you could we could get a little bit more feedback for you before you take it to the Planning Commission.
It'd be really easy for me to make the changes and send out an email, you know, as a PDF, and you guys to take, you know, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever you need, and go over it and then talk about it again at the next PWEB meeting. Like Rob said, you know, we're already using this list for our city street trees. So as far as it getting it approved, the only point to getting it approved sooner would be to get it to the citizens. Now, the public's not going to be able to get this list until we get it approved because it's not going to be available. But our staff already is. So, and then, you know, they've been using this information before we even started updating the list. So I think as far as usefulness, if we want to bring it back to PWEB here again, that's fine. But if you want it to get to the citizens, then yes, the timeline is more important.
Okay, then do we have a consensus? If you could finish up the tree list, I mean, it makes sense what June is saying, and since you have no oppositions there, Taylor, bring us a more completed list. You can send it to us electronically,
yeah,
and then we can just talk about it
at the next meeting.
And then it should be a fairly short.
Yeah, especially if you've already looked at it.
And then you can send it on to the Planning Commission.
Correct.
The next PWEB meeting...
I didn't hear about that.
And how will this be emailed to us? Will it come through Public Works, or
you could send it to me, and then I could forward it on to the.
Great. Thank you.
Do we have a PWEB meeting in July?
We have one on the schedule for July.
Okay. Sorry. So July.
But you're not going to have a quorum at the July meeting. And that's why I was suggesting we go ahead and accept it. We have an idea of how it's going to be. It's just a matter of them putting it into form that we can look at.
Well, to backtrack, why we won't have a quorum, so we aren't going to have a meeting in July? Is that what I'm hearing?
Rob was saying earlier,
know why
we can.
You wouldn't have a quorum in July.
Okay. I won't be here.
Then you won't have a quorum.
That's right.
That's why we're not going to have a.
We'd have Bill.
But
what
we. Okay, so that's a good suggestion.
So it would be August before we have another meeting?
August before you had a quorum, we could still hold a meeting. But it's probably best if some of the other items that are coming up would be best with the fuller group, because I think we want to bring the utility billing structure and conservation back for the next PWAP meeting. We're getting ahead of ourselves with the future agenda items, but maybe we could just direct Taylor to bring this back at the next PWAP meeting, either July or August, and we'll let him know, you know, as soon as possible when that's going to be.
I think we already know there's not going to be.
Oh, that's right. We're not going to have a quorum for July.
So,
yeah, sorry.
It seems to me that we're postponing this, and we could be moving ahead on getting it done. And from everything I've seen, I can't see there's going to be a big problem with it. I'm not going to question the trees.
I'd just like to see the detail, the final.
Would you be opposed, June, in terms of we can make a motion to send the finished, Taylor could send the finished format to Planning Commission, but we get a copy first?
Well, I'd like to think that we would have some input before it goes to the Planning Commission. One more opportunity to have some input. And that can be informal if it doesn't work out to come to a meeting.
Because you're on the tree committee.
She's kind of compact.
Okay.
I mean, like I said, I think that getting it to the citizens is the ultimate goal. But, and I know a lot of people on the tree committee would like to see it move forward to the Planning Commission. And if you don't have any major concerns with the format or the tree, to send it to you guys and give you at least a week to 2 weeks to send me any concerns back on the final draft before I go to the Planning Commission with it. But from what I've heard from you right now, I'm not hearing any major problems.
The only thing I would add, I'm ready to have it go forward personally, and especially given that next month. The only thing I would say is that this gray water application is very interesting, and it's like a 180 from what I would normally think would be on a tree list, meaning drought tolerant, drought tolerant, drought tolerant. So maybe some way to just designate, these are the couple trees that aren't drought tolerant. So if you plant these, you better be prepared to get them a lot of water.
Well, that would be because I still have those other two sublists to make, the gray water, the third one being the private resident and gray water reclamation list.
Right.
In its criteria at the top, it would be very obvious that these trees require water.
Okay.
And that's basically, you know, because we do have places, even in our parks, like you go down to Lila Kaiser and, you know, where you're watering the lawn, there's water available for a tree that uses a lot of water. So, you know, that would be a good place to put a tree on that list. And but besides that, all the other rest of the trees in the city yard need to be drought tolerant. So that's by making that sub-list, I would meet that.
All right. I guess we're ready for a motion. No, go ahead.
Chair, I have a suggestion maybe to, if you want to forward this on to Planning Commission, perhaps Taylor forwards the revised list to the board members, and then they could forward their comments on to Planning Commission so that they get incorporated in their review of the project. In fact, you can even, you know, come to the Planning Commission of that meeting and present your comments, or, you know, forward them the form of written correspondence to them.
I'd be comfortable with that.
Cool. I'm not sure of what the format should be for making the motion, but I'd like to move that we do send it on to the Planning Commission with our recommendation that it copies be made available for us to see, but that we don't need to hold up on this, because otherwise there's going to be a couple of months delay. And I realize, and it sounds like there's been something in place for a long time. So this way, and if we, and it says in here, if we want to change it, we can. Mm.
So, one, can I try it?
You bet.
Or would some? Would you guys like to do it?
Go ahead.
You're going to have to help anyway, I think. All right. The motion is on the table to forward this street tree list to, or no, street, Morro Bay Volunteer Tree Committee Master Tree List, move it on to the Planning Commission. As in its present format, with the caveat that the additions will be made and the list will be forwarded back to us PWAB members in the next week or two. And then if we have any ideas or additions, we can attend or send our comments to Planning Commission.
Or directly to Taylor, correct?
Or to Rob.
Was that clear enough?
I think it is.
It's long, but it's clear.
Kathy, did you get that?
We can make it shorter.
We'll either Kathy has it right now, or we also have the tape to view.
I'll second that motion.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, Richard, for moving us along. All right, and now for the most patient person in the audience. We now have a presentation on the bicycle empowerment presentation from the San Luis Obispo Bicycle Coalition. Thank you, Tim.
All right. Thank you so much, board members, for having me today. My name is Dan Revoir, and I'm the executive director at the San Luis Obispo County Bicycle Coalition. Got to add that in there, because we're always striving to reach out to more of the county and do more programming. Folks up here on the North Coast, up in North County, and of course down in South County as well. Before I move on and talk about the Bike Empowerment Workshop or the Bike Smarts Workshop, I'd just like to give you a little bit of feedback or background information about who the Bike Coalition is and what we do. The Bicycle Coalition is a nonprofit group in San Luis Obispo County whose mission it is to make San Luis Obispo or transform San Luis Obispo County into a safer and more livable community by promoting biking and walking for everyday transportation and recreation. So we believe that by promoting biking and walking, we can make our community better. Simple. The ways that we do that, and the ways that the sort of the rubber meets the road for the Bike Coalition, are twofold. One is that we advocate with local governments, whether it be the city government, county government, or its programs, are to reach out to those barriers and strip them down so that people can choose to ride their bike. So we have a bicycle empowerment program, or bicycle confidence program, which is why I'm here today. It's part of that program to educate people in the ways that they can ride their bike and about the rules of the road and other things to make them feel safe when they're riding their bike. We have a bike parking program called Bike Valet, where we provide free bike parking at community events. That's like at a summer concert or something like that. The bike valet is just like a coat check, and you'd be able to ride up and park your bike there while you attended the event. It's surprising sometimes how much of a barrier bike parking is, or parking is, to individuals. It applies to people who are coming to community events and trying to shop downtown, and it applies to people on bikes as well. And one of our other programs is called the Bike Kitchen, where we teach bike maintenance, and we try to empower people to learn how to fix their own flat tires or adjust their own derailleurs. That's a little bit of background about the Bike Coalition. Gave you this, our most recent newsletter. There's a lot of information in there about our programming, and I invite you to check that out. I also brought flyers for the 4th of July bike parade. I'm not sure if this at all, in any way played into your inviting me here today, but we are doing programming and events up here in the North Coast. And in Morro Bay, for the 4th of July, part of the family fun of the day is to do a bike parade from the Rock to Tidelands Park, where everyone is invited to attend. We'll do a brief bike safety presentation beforehand, and then we'll ride out there, or ride in together. So I'm going to drop these off as well. Bike valet will be provided if you choose to go shopping on the Embarcadero or whatever while you're hanging out on the 4th of July. All right. So the biggest barrier to cycling is safety. I'm sure all of you have probably ridden a bike at some point in your life, may or may not ride a bike currently today or on a weekly basis or whatever. And I'm sure in some way or another, your concern for your own safety plays into why you don't. Safety is a huge issue. Our culture and our roads are set up for vehicles, and when we're riding our bikes, we feel intimidated that we might get hit by a car on a vehicle. We hear horror stories about bad accidents. And there's a lot of myths that have been sort of risen to the top that make us feel unsafe on our bikes. So at the Coalition, with our Bike Confidence Program, we aim to strip that down. And the best way to do it is by talking about the statistics, the rules of the road, and that sort of thing. We have formal workshops in the Bike Confidence Program that are 4 hours long. Or every other month, and I invite you to check that out in our newsletter. I also have a flyer here today and some more information. If you're interested in taking the whole workshop, you really get the full experience. We talk more about the style of riding we recommend, and we also get out and ride our bikes ourselves. Putting it into practice is the best thing you can do for learning how to ride safely. So, we're worried on our bikes that we're going to get hit by a car. One of the biggest myths that we encounter when we're scared to ride, safety becomes a big barrier. And so I brought a couple of displays over here that really help us look at statistics that will highlight some of the myths of riding and will segue into a style of riding that we call vehicular cycling, which is an advised way to ride your bike that will make you safer. So first thing is the chart on top. Draw your attention to that. And there's a big headline right at the top, and of course, this is going to go right to the core of that myth, which is cyclists blame cars constantly for any accident that happens, and we're scared of cars when we ride our bike. However, most crashes do not involve a motor vehicle. It's simply not the case that vehicles are the biggest threat on the road. And I think it's really important to note that as a cyclist. Where we feel unsafe, and we feel like every time I get in an accident on my bike, it's almost always going to be fatal because it's going to be involving some big truck or a moving van or something. That's just simply not the case. Most falls on a bicycle are, as you can see there, the big piece of the pie is a solo fall, where I'm riding along on the street and I lose control of my bike and it tips over and I skid my knee and that's it. It's just like when we were a kid, nothing that bad, or the crash of another cyclist. So the biggest pieces of that pie do not even involve a motor vehicle. So 18% does. And that's the 18% most people are scared about, and that's the 18% that prohibits people from riding. We're so scared to ride because of the crashes with cars. And I'm sure the drivers of the cars think that whenever there's a car crash between a vehicle and a bicycle, it's the cyclist's fault. And the cyclists all think it's the driver's fault. And, it can go back and forth, and of course there's myths associated thereof. However, if we look at some of the data about that, and this is generated through a couple of bike surveys and traffic safety reports through Caltrans and other organizations. This is a national figure. However, it's important to note that it's basically balanced. So crashes that involve a car and a bike, who's at fault? It's pretty even. And so first and foremost, I want to focus on the couple of things that cyclists do that cause crashes, where the cyclist is at fault. And this is quickly going to illustrate the important points of vehicular cycling or this style of cycling that we advocate here at the Bike Coalition. So the first thing that cyclists do where it's their fault and they caused a collision is ride the wrong way on the street. I'm sure you guys have seen it happening before. People riding up the sidewalk the wrong way or riding against traffic in a bike lane. And a lot of us were taught to do that when we were young, you know, kids or whatever, because the drivers are looking right at you, Mom and Dad said. They'll see you when they're riding towards you. And that's something that's been kind of ingrained in our culture, but it's a very dangerous way to ride your bike because when vehicles are driving, they are looking for other vehicles. They're trying to avoid other, or the drivers are avoiding other vehicles, and so they're always looking left into traffic to watch for other vehicles. And if you're coming up the wrong side of the road, it's simply not where vehicles look for a pedestrian or whatever, and that's why bad accidents happen when cyclists are riding the wrong way. The two other pieces that cyclists do that cause crashes are you maybe were going faster than they thought, or they thought you were also making a right-hand turn or whatever, and so they bumped into you. The final piece of the pie, and this is, there's a lot of detail there, but the piece of the pie I like to bring up now, and it's a higher level in San Luis Obispo County, is dooring. Dooring is when you're riding next to a parked car and the door flies open and you run into it. Dooring is the driver's fault. They're supposed to look in their rearview mirror or do a shoulder check before you open your door. But it's something that, while it is the motorist's fault, behavioral change by the bicyclist could easily get you out of that circumstance. And so that's the perfect segue into vehicular cycling. Vehicular cycling sounds like a weird term, right? It's sort of self-explanatory. It has something to do with being a vehicle. But for us, what we simply tell people and when we tell school children at our school assemblies is you drive your bike. You don't ride your bike. You drive your bike. You drive your bike like you would drive a car. A bicycle is classified as a vehicle in the state of California. They have the same rules, the same rights, the same roads. They're allowed to take the lane in circumstances that there's debris in the road or they're passing another vehicle. A cyclist is allowed to ride past another cyclist and pass them, or in any circumstance where there's a potential right turn conflict or anything, the cyclist can get off the right edge of the road and get into the lane. So a bicycle is classified as a vehicle, and therefore they have the same rules, same rights, same road. They have to stop at stop signs. They can't exceed the speed limit. They have to stop at stoplights, etc. And so by teaching this sort of driving your bike mentality, we can eliminate almost all of the major issues and the collisions there. So first, solo fall, running into another cyclist, running into a parked car or an animal or a pedestrian. But many of those issues can be addressed by being very attentive when we ride our bikes. It's important to know that solo fall and running into another cyclist are the biggest pieces. You need to pay attention when you're riding so that those sorts of things don't happen. But when we talk about car-bike crashes, riding or driving your bike is one of the best ways to address many of those issues. And so part of our curriculum is to really focus in on that and articulate to people what the best behavior is. Like I said, it is a cyclist's right to exit the right side of the road or the right-hand curb in order to avoid a potential right hook. Or if they're entering an intersection and the cyclist is continuing straight through an intersection, the cyclist should be in the center lane or in the center of the lane if there's only one. That way, drivers around them know that they're going straight. If I'm hanging out on the right side of the lane, I sort of am inadvertently communicating to the other drivers that I'm making a right-hand turn. Likewise, if I'm making a left-hand turn. So at the Coalition and in the sort of greater curriculum that's taught for safe and smart cycling, it's always advised that a bicyclist simply follow the rules like they would if they were in their car. Like I said, there's a whole lot of information, and really the best way to kind of live this experience and feel the level of empowerment that you get from driving your bike is to get together with some friends or family or whatever and try it yourself. Or to take one of our workshops and we go through the practices in greater depth. We go through the statistics in greater depth. And by doing that, you'll immediately feel or understand how powerful it is to be riding like a vehicle. Not only will cars see you better and understand you better, the traffic will flow better around you, and ultimately you'll be less likely to get in a collision. Before I wrap up, and I don't want to take too much more of your time, there are, of course, a couple of things that are very important for cycling that come, in my opinion, a little bit further down the ladder that are very important things to keep you safe. So for us, what I really believe is the number one most important thing that we can do to make cycling safer as an activity and strip down that barrier and get more people riding is to teach them some of these safe practices, what their rights are, what the vehicle code says about cycling, and that sort of thing. So riding your bike like you drive your car is probably the most important thing you can do to avoid an accident. Of course, there's a couple of things that you can do as well to make yourself much safer, especially in cases that you're riding at night and et cetera. In the state of California, children under the age of 18 are required to wear a helmet when they ride their bike. Helmets aren't going to stop you from getting in a crash. The helmet will not do a dang thing in stopping that from happening. It's all your rider behavior and whether or not vehicles are seeing you. But what a helmet will do is stop you from getting a horrible head trauma when you do get in a crash. And so at the Bike Coalition, we wear helmets constantly. I wear a helmet every day. I ride my bike to work, to school, to meetings, etc. And we advocate to everybody that they should ride their bike, even though it's not required in the state of California. If a person is under 18, it is. So that's something you can share with your family and friends. It's important to wear a helmet safely, and most people don't wear their helmets in the proper manner. And so there's an easy rule that we use called the two-finger rule, which will help you fit a helmet on a child or a friend if they don't seem to be wearing it properly. It's very simple. The helmet goes on top of your head. You can take the two fingers and put them on your forehead just above your eyebrows. The front of the helmet should sit right there on the top of your fingers. You can split those fingers into a different thing. There's a lot of little accessories that different cyclists will use. This is a giveaway that the city of San Luis Obispo has taken advantage of to try to promote being seen at night when you're riding. But ultimately, the vehicle code states that you are lit if you ride at night. And so that's one thing we also like to focus on, which is you need to have a headlight that can be seen by 500 feet in front of you, and a rear reflector that can be seen at least 300 feet behind you. We advise to have a rear blinking light or some sort of red LED light in the back. That makes it even more obvious. And there's a couple of other requirements in the vehicle code that are commonly observed and followed by bike shops, but not always on bikes. And that's a requirement for yellow reflectors on your pedals and white reflectors on your wheels and that sort of thing. So being seen is important, but once again, riding your bike like you're driving a car is really the most important thing that you can do to avoid these major portions of the car collisions. So, like I said, there's a lot more information. The Bicycle Coalition is fighting for a more bike-friendly San Luis Obispo County. We do have a couple of additional programs that we do to encourage people to ride and to offer opportunities for education. One of our programs that you'll see in the newsletter is called Kidical Mass. It's a kids and family, a kid and parent get together where you can just hop on your bike and ride a little short distance. So far, we've only done it in San Luis Obispo. But it's a family-friendly ride where you can come together with your kids and show them that they should be riding, you know, in a certain way, and you get to give them the opportunity to do that. Part of what we're doing here at the Morro Bay 4th and the bike parade is doing just that. We've been getting a lot of advice from myself and our Kidical Mass family outreach manager at the Bike Coalition, and so we're trying to bring that opportunity to this community. We're also interested in doing more workshops with the schools, and of course working for a more bike-friendly Morro Bay with your bike plan and that sort of thing. So thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it, and if you do have any questions or more information, or if you'd like more information, just go ahead and ask.
I have one question. You talked about avoiding dooring. Is that a legal reason to go into the middle of the lane if there's parked cars there and you're concerned with them opening?
Absolutely.
Okay.
If there are parked cars and the lane is too narrow to share, so if the road is a small lane, mm-hmm. then we advise that you take the lane and you put yourself out in a prominent location in the lane so that vehicles will definitely see you and so that you won't get doored. mean, a door is not going to go flying off a car. It can only go 3 feet out. So if you're riding 3 feet from parked cars, you simply will never get doored. But it's important to feel confident enough to get out of that door zone and to ride a little bit more in the lane and to know that it's your right to do so. So that's something we do advise. We also are very, very sensitive at the Bike Coalition to the potential for a negative relationship between drivers and cyclists. We don't want our cyclists to start riding like vehicles at the expense of drivers' convenience altogether. And so we have a couple of flyers. I brought some with me here. This one is called Give, Get, Respect, and Know Your Rights. It's a two-sided little flyer. We want cyclists to give respect to drivers, to observe stop signs and stoplights, and act like other vehicles of the road, which earns them some respect, and then at the same time to give respect to the other vehicles around them and know that they can share the lane. Our Share the Road campaign, we have commercials and stuff, which we've aired on public access and on some regular channels around here whenever we have grant funding. But sharing the road with the vehicles around us is a big priority to the Bike Coalition. We're sensitive to the fact that that can go awry when people are riding this way. But
I try to ride like a vehicle on my bike, but I feel like there's a lot of confusion with drivers. It's not just the bicyclists that need to be educated to do that. I feel like the drivers, I get feedback sometimes like, well, what are you doing in the lane? And you shouldn't be there. You should be to the side. You should be coming facing traffic. So it's not just bicyclists that need to be educated. I think it's also the driving public just doesn't understand why bicyclists sometimes are out there with them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we're working on actually getting a little bit more of information available at the DMV for new drivers and get that integrated into the bike education program. That's not an issue that we can quite tackle at the Slo County Bike Coalition, but we are members of a statewide organization that is trying to work towards those things. And then the other thing is we're also working with like AAA and other organizations that provide information to vehicle drivers to let them know that it's a bicyclist's right to be out there and they need to share the road. I mean, we all pay into the taxes that generate and build our roads. We should all be able to use them. There should be affordable mobility to people who can't afford to drive a car. And so that's important. And so we are working on that. Part of our bike education program is it's a contracted program with the city of San Luis Obispo. We're working on talking to more communities around the county to let them know that we are, interested in teaching their community to ride bikes. It's just difficult to stretch our resources. And so in any ways that, say a Parks and Rec Foundation or something.
Bike committee. And it says that the bike someone's contributing $425 to have the bike valet come park bicycles at Tidelands Park. I guess my question is, if someone wants to have the bike valet at their event, is there a fee for that? Is it a donation? Tell me more.
It is classified as a donation to a 501c3 group, so it is tax deductible. We do have to assess the value of the service into that donation. So it's just like if you made a donation to a 501c3 group and they gave you a T-shirt, you wouldn't be able to write off the full value. They do have to assess the value of what they're giving you. So it's tax deductible. There is a fee. We charge $75 an hour if our organization administers the recruitment for staffing and volunteering and that sort of thing. And if the event planners decide to help us with the volunteer recruitment, then we cut that down to $50 an hour, and we do nonprofit discounts and all that other sort of stuff as well. There's been information on our website under Bike Valet. You'll see programs, and you can click that. And we're happy to do more and more events. Most recently, we did Waterfest out here at The Rock. That was, I think, the first time we did Bike Valet here in Morro Bay. But we've parked, since the inception of that program, which was in late 2006, we've parked over 16,000 bicycles. That's 16,000 vehicle trips that were replaced by a bicycle. And that means, better air quality, better health for our citizens, a little extra money in their pockets to go spend at our local restaurants and stuff. And we really do deeply believe that this is a good way to better our community. So.
Well, thanks a lot for coming down.
Thanks for having me. I really
all right.
appreciate it.
And we'll look for you at the 4th of July bike parade.
Yeah, come on down. We're going to meet at The Rock at 11. If you meet us around then, we'll kind of gather together, and then we're going to ride as a group down the Embarcadero. If you don't have a bike, set up a lawn chair and watch us. But if you do, come and join us. It'll be a lot of fun. It's a participatory parade, There'll be some bells and whistles, but unless you get there and get behind your handlebars, you won't really get to feel the fun of being on your bike.
Do you want people to dress up if they're
sure.
going to be in the ride?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We'll have a couple of people dressed up already. The theme is Happy Birthday, America. It says there on the flyer, I believe. And so Uncle Sam will be there, and a number of us will be there with all sorts of fun kind of bikes. We'll have music, we'll have that sort of stuff. I'm trying to decide, but I have a fun, goofy bike called a tall bike. You may have seen some of those around the community. It's two bikes welded on top of each other. It's really fun for the kids to see the mechanics of how a bike works in that sort of way. And so we'll be there just trying to show people how many smiles it puts on your face to be behind your two wheels.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for coming out.
Do you guys like a reflective snap thing? Or
we also have a campaign that we launched to help our high school students.
Cool.
Yeah,
for the community out there at large, definitely come to the Morro Bay 4th of July bike parade at 11 o'clock at Morro Rock. We will be distributing iBike MB stickers at the parade, and we'll be having a really fun time out there behind our handlebars.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. We'll see you July 4th.
Thank you, Dan.
Okay. Moving on to the next item on the agenda, the approval of minutes from April 21st. We have a motion to approve the minutes. And a second. And all those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Moving on to the director's report. Does anybody, if we want to open up, anybody would like to make comments? Richard, we'll start over here with you.
Sorry about that. I'd like to know what's happening in correcting the situation at Quintana and South Bay Boulevard. Again, the other day we saw another wreck there, and it's and one of the cars was messed up pretty badly. But I've also noticed that when I sent in that thing, I didn't talk about putting in a left turn lane. And if you're on South Bay Boulevard, for somebody to make a left turn, they have to be in the center line. The other person has to go out into the shoulder. And so there needs to be something to correct that. And then when you're coming south on South Bay, the mountain or whatever you call that thing is out there in such a way that you have to be out almost into the intersection to see if there's a car or something coming from the north. And so it's quite dangerous.
And make sure that it was a preventable accident. It wasn't due to drunk driving or something that really we have no control over.
Right. I know several police cars were there at that particular, and this happened about maybe 2 weeks ago, and I haven't seen anything since then. But it's, but on the road coming north on South Bay, there is enough room on the, I can't think of what you call the area on the side, the shoulder, to have another lane, because it's dangerous to have your car out there and other cars coming up behind you. And contrary to it saying 30 miles per hour, I doubt seriously that 1 in 10 is going 30 miles an hour behind you. Yes, I am. No.
No, there
and
isn't
at this point, there on I happened to look at the other day, and at Quintana it has both a left turn lane and a right turn lane. But on that, on the South Bay, where you have much more traffic, there isn't. Either going south nor going north. And there, on the one side, what we call the shoulder, I think there'd be enough room to put a lane over there so it'd make it safer to get by.
Yeah, and I think probably the reason that was never striped for turns is just the sheer number of vehicle counts, that it's usually a through movement there. It's north to south there. 99% of the movements at that intersection are traveling basically from Los Osos to Highway 1 at that location. There isn't a lot of cross traffic, but this is a project that we have going. We've just been a little slow at getting to it.
Okay. And I probably expressed more interest in it because I live up on the hill.
Correct.
And my sister and her husband live in the park the other side. When we go back and forth, you're always dodging traffic one way or the other. And
I still contend that it's an ideal place. Maybe not ideal, but a good place for another turning circle.
Roundabout.
Thank you. The words are getting stuck tonight. But anyway, because then traffic would keep moving. That north-south traffic most of the time could just keep moving through that intersection. And it would slow them down a little bit if they had to do a roundabout. But I know those are not easy things to make happen here.
Does anybody else have any comments about the director's report?
I do.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Let's see. I have a couple questions. Okay. The Chorro Valley water situation. I read here it says, with both the groundwater nitrate contamination and requirements of the groundwater rule continue to provide water to customers outside the city limits, as was done in the past, has become untenable. So in other words, it's not practical to do that anymore. I know about the nitrate contamination, but I don't know what the groundwater rule is. I've never heard of that before.
We're required to not use our wells in the Chorro Valley when stream flows are below a certain flow rate. And so we're doing some interference studies, but we were directed by council to work with all the property owners that are outside the city limits to come up with an equitable severing of our relationship with those property owners and get them off of city water and onto their own water source.
So groundwater rule is?
Is basically the groundwater rule is water you're pulling out of the ground may be influenced by that surface water. So water under the influence of a surface water has to be treated like a surface water. So to continue to provide water when we're not on state water would require us to build some sort of water treatment plant out there as a municipality providing water out there. So that's why we were directed by council to work with the property owners and come up with a resolution to this water issue and get them off of the city water. So there's, I think, around 11 customers out there that are provided, have historical water use outside of the city limits, and some with agreements, some without agreements, and we're working on those with those customers.
So you're moving forward. It's
yes.
Not all settled yet.
It isn't. And it may be quite some time before it is settled.
It's probably a big thing to those homeowners.
It really is.
Yeah. Speaking of big things, I know
parks maintenance workers, and we only have two streets maintenance workers, rather than take on another level of supervision and more folks in the public services department to move our two streets workers into the parks and recreation, and it's creating this new maintenance division. So it'll consist of facilities maintenance, the mechanic, and streets and parks. Water, and wastewater collections, and wastewater will still remain in public services.
Does that mean then we will not, as part of the board for public services, we will not be made as aware of street tree issues and any tree issues that go on in the parks, which we already really weren't much a part of?
We're still working on the mechanics of the sort of the office staffing of that, how that's going to work. I'll still retain the city engineer. City engineer has a certain legal responsibility for the city streets, so public services will still be providing the engineering for streets, storm drain, so we'll the day-to-day operations will is what's moving to Parks and Recreation. We may have to have the maintenance superintendent occasionally attend our Public Works Advisory Board to perhaps give us updates on that type of maintenance.
Then I guess I can, that leads into my next question, which I guess you can still answer, which is there's a notation here that on July 1st you're going to start doing tree removal and routine trimming of our trees, street trees. So do we have trees on the list to be removed?
I think we have a small list for this coming year. Not a fairly small list, but we'll be working with our Recreation and Parks Department to establish a trimming list. Typically, we try not to do it between July 1st and Labor Day, especially in the downtown area. Because it does interfere with the economy, the tourist economy. So typically that happens more towards the fall. Talking with some of the local arborists, for some of the trees that we need to trim, it would be best if it happened actually much later in the year when it's a little bit cooler. Unfortunately, then we're bumping up against the other end of the nesting season. So that may be an ordinance that we have to revisit and fine-tune about maybe requiring some sort of biological review of the tree before it gets trimmed, but it still can be trimmed during that so-called nesting season, because there's really a range of dates, and not every bird nests from January through June.
So you don't? Do you have any idea of how many trees are listed to be removed? Not so much the trimming, but at this point in time, how many trees do you anticipate removing?
I don't have. Yeah, we don't. I don't think we have a list of any to be removed. Most of them are trimmings at this point in time. I did notice a couple of Monterey pines that are starting to get browner and browner. That happens pretty quickly. So we would probably get a request for removal fairly soon after they turn brown.
And I'd like to bring up, as I have before, that we do have an ordinance, I believe, that says any tree that is removed is to be replaced.
Yes.
Okay. Have any further, June?
One more. The bike paths, citywide bike lanes. Planning Commission added class one bike lanes on Beachcomber and Sandalwood, where they're talking about making those one-way streets so that we can have class one bike lanes.
That was the Planning Commission's recommendation, was to one-way those streets and have class one on there. It would also probably eliminate parking on one side of the street in addition to making one way.
And that's part of the city bike plan?
That is their recommendation. We're working with SLOCOG and Caltrans and refining the bike plan. That would get incorporated as a recommendation when it goes to city council. And when city council approves it, then it would become part of the bike plan.
I have a question about that. You're talking about turning Beachcomber into a one-way street, the entire length of Beachcomber, or just to the creek, the south of the creek?
The Planning Commission's recommendation was San Jacinto to Yerba Buena. Yes, that was in there as it went to Planning Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So they forwarded that on also, so that was still in the bike plan. Now we've looked at some... the retaining wall and other physical barriers are in the way from doing that, and we're looking at other potential options that may provide other solutions to it. And it was suggested that we look at an example from the city of San Luis, the Santa Barbara Morrow Bike Boulevard method of getting across an intersection where all the everything goes red, mm-hmm. and then there's a diagonal crossing allowed at that point in time. Trying to look at refining some details with that before we bring that back around to this board and planning commission as a potential alternative to a class one bike path there. It might be workable. The product really isn't ready to present. I have concerns that right now it puts bikers, bicyclists, very far out into the intersection to make it workable. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many people would be willing to use that if you're just surrounded by paint lines and you're sticking way out in the middle of an intersection. Because there needs to be a refuge area so that those people that still want to go straight along the Class 2 facility can continue to make that continue on. But there has to be some refuge area there. So we're trying to work out the details of getting that to work.
And it would have to be highly sensitive to bicyclists, the weight of a bicyclist,
yes.
there to trigger it. Otherwise, yes. it wouldn't be effective.
Interesting either. Enough, when we're observing that intersection, I noticed a few bicyclists that actually use that left turn pocket right at that intersection.
Mm-hmm.
They'll
northbound.
Northbound mm-hmm. intersection, not the one down below by Limos,
mm-hmm.
but the one up
mm-hmm.
above. And it does trigger the left turn ball.
I must need to eat more because I don't trigger it. So it might only work for people over a certain weight. Good. Well, I'm glad you're looking into other solutions to that intersection that hasn't been forgotten.
No, definitely
okay.
not.
Great.
Do you have any? No? June, are you finished?
Yeah.
Okay. I had a couple. I guess we'll go back to streets and sidewalks. And I do recall in the past number of months, you talked about the priority list in the city of different street issues that you have in terms of potholes or stuff that you have a working list, Rob?
We're working on our pavement management system. Last summer, we did a complete inventory of the city's street system and basically ranked the streets as far as their damage and their level of repairs that are needed, entered that information into a computer program called MicroPaver, which is an industry standard for evaluating street conditions. We're now working on the policy document side of that. So typically these policy documents recommend what you get out of MicroPaver is something called a it assesses what the pavement condition index is. It's a 0 through a 100 scale. Typically, a lot of cities don't want their streets to drop below a 70 on that rating. A lot of our streets in town are in the 40, 20, 10 rating on that scale, mainly because of the way the street system evolved in Morro Bay. The streets, especially on the north end of town, evolved from Red Rock County roads to being chip sealed by the county and then having an overlay sometime during the 80s, maybe early 90s. Our really last robust paving program was in the early 2000s. After that point in time, state money dried up for local street maintenance, and we don't see a lot of street money besides the gas tax money for local street maintenance these days. The city has 53 miles of paved city-maintained streets in town. We're probably 50 or 55. It almost goes vertical at that point in time. So streets fail rather rapidly if they're not maintained and preserved. That's why the kind of the mantra of us asphalt junkies is pavement preservation. We want to preserve what we have because the preservation costs are so much less than the reconstruction costs are. And I would like to get to that point in Morro Bay where we're doing true pavement preservation. Unfortunately, we're not quite there yet. We're going to have to spend some serious money on street reconstruction.
Okay.
So that's a rather long answer to your question. I apologize.
No, I appreciate that because that's information that, I mean, a number of people who live around me in North Morro Bay have approached me because I know that I'm on this board, and they ask about the priorities of the streets, namely, and you've already, the tree, I mean, not the tree, the streets department did take care of the the problem on Bonita Street in front of the fire department and the trailer park, but however, it's a recurring problem, and it's getting just as bad as it was 6 or 8 months ago. But knowing that, and you telling me this, this is a good way to be able to explain it to people in our neighborhood.
And currently, you know, the city, our main maintenance activity on streets is pothole patching. So we do encourage people to call into public services, 772-6261. Maybe after July 1st that number is going to change, but until I announce a new number, we'll continue to use that number to report potholes. Now, we may not get to it the next day. It may be a couple of weeks before we get to it. But every call that we get for a pothole is logged, and there's a work order created, and we track those, and we make sure that they get done.
Now, that was a very nice comeback. That was perfect. I have another question about bike paths on page 3. Do we have an I realize 53 miles of roads in the city. Do we have a map of existing bike paths?
In our bike plan, there was an exhibit with existing and proposed bicycle facilities. That plan, I believe, is still posted on our website, so you could view it there. I know the copy that this board received was in black and white, and it looked like it was copied several times. It wasn't the most readable document of the world. But it is available on our website, and so it does show those Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 facilities on there, existing and proposed.
Okay, thanks. And now my last question. This has to do with water, and I don't know it's Dylan's the staff contact, but let's see if you can answer it. Has to do with the amount of production that we are seeing from State Water and our brackish water and desal. Do you have any idea how much the city can produce with our desal in terms of acre feet?
I can't answer that question. I'm sorry. Okay.
No, that's totally fine. I was just curious, being that State Water, we're coming into our high season where we're going to need a lot of water, and knowing that we're getting a lot from our allocation, but I was just curious about our water trains and desal and how much we could get. So it's just simple curiosity.
I do know that we can keep up with our winter demands with our desal plant combined with our wells. So we can keep up with our winter. As we observed, we didn't run any tanks dry this winter. So we can keep up with our winter demand. So that combined with now we're up to a 40% allocation for State Water. So anything above, I believe it's 30%, because we have a drought buffer, we get our full allocation of State Water.
So then right now we're just purposely taking a huge majority of State Water because we're on State Water, and we're just letting the aquifers be until we need them?
Our desal plant, it makes most sense to either run it or not run it. It doesn't operate very well, start and stop. So, for example, during the winter season, during state water shutdown, we ran it. And then when state water was low and couldn't keep really up with the demand, we continued to run our brackish water treatment units, our desal plant.
Damaris and Rob, go for it.
Thank you. Yes, this is our first annual report. We just finished our first year under our stormwater permit. And Damaris has compiled this annual report that is in a draft stage right now. We're hoping to get it to the Regional Water Quality Control Board sometime this month. So it is organized by our required six required control measures, and it states our status on complying with each of those. And I'll turn it over to Damaris to highlight some of those, the highlights of this year's annual report.
Just to go over a few of the highlights, we had a residential brochure on page 10. You can see a copy of it. You should have all received one in the mail. We mapped our storm drain system with GIS mapping, and we completed it complete this year. We had 2 years to do it, but we actually got it all completed this first year. We also did a survey. We also did a survey for the restaurant and foods facilities. To get a general idea of what BMPs they do use or don't use. On page 13 shows a example of our tourist sign that we're going to put up. It's kind of just in the design phase now. And then we...
Question.
Uh-huh?
The sign looks wonderful. Where were you thinking of putting it?
We don't have exact locations yet. It's somewhere in the Embarcadero area. We have two. We'll do two. Same thing, just two of the exact same one. Hopefully one on the Harbor Walk and then one somewhere else in the vicinity. We're not sure exactly where yet. And then we've also been working with the regional joint effort to develop the hydro modification plan. We've all been on attack for that for a while now. And so those are just a couple of the highlights within the plan. And if you guys have any other questions.
Just
start going around if you'd like.
Okay, we'll begin with Jenny B. Thank you. This was exciting reading, honestly. And I'll just go through some. One comment was that the brochures, I read that someone commented to you that the brochures seemed like they cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Who was the printer that printed the brochures?
Hayes Printing.
Okay.
They printed them for us, yeah.
Okay. Just curious.
Okay.
Hayes Printing?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, that's right. Okay, next to the sushi place. Got it.
Yeah.
Just want to make a note. You'll probably catch this, but in the signage for the tourists, Land and Sea are linked, there was a typo on the sign. Okay, you got that.
Yeah, we did.
Okay, good. Just hate to see that. Notice that City of Morro Bay response time for follow-up actions on the hotline.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully there will be fewer and fewer violations that are being reported, mm-hmm. because they are fewer. But I saw that the two of you went out and responded to these calls much like a SWAT team of two. And it as exciting as, you know, I see the costumes and everything, but what I wanted to ask is if we want to encourage reporting of violations to the hotline, mm-hmm. and have a policing of these violations, I was surprised to see that it was you guys going out there and checking in on the violations. You have the expertise to see what's going on and to decide whether it's a bad thing or not. But I just felt like, couldn't that be something that our police department would handle instead of the overtaxed public works staff? I don't know. It was just something that crossed my mind as I saw that.
I think you would get an equal argument from the PD that they're also overtaxed. they don't really have the technical expertise to respond to these. It's really our goal is to get our building inspector to be able to respond to these. Also, our wastewater collections crew also assists on responding to these. You'll see me responding to these much less in my new role in the city.
Okay. It was just something I was surprised to see in here. Something else I thought was very fascinating was on page 21, the itemized list of things that were found in the coastal cleanup, cigarette butts being number one, et cetera, et cetera. I just thought that was fun to see what else I have. Thanks for letting me just do it all at once. And I think that was it, I'm pretty sure. No, right here. Oh, street sweeping. So it says that the neighborhoods are being swept once a month. I'm not giving my opinion on whether street sweeping is good or bad, but if it's going to happen and we're paying for it, I noticed I happened to be home when the street sweeper came by my street, and I was really surprised, like, oh, look, the street sweeper. And I happened to see that there were a lot of parked cars on the street that day, and there was no notice. I know it would be an expensive proposition to notify, but somehow to have the street be cleared for street sweeping, if it's only going to be once a month, if there's some schedule or something that we could do to inform the residents that you are getting your street swept, and don't park your cars on the side of the street during those times. Comments on that, or you're just gonna make note?
Yeah, it would probably be most effective in the downtown to make sure that the cars are off the street when they sweep. In the residential district, typically, in past, the theory was they get to the residential area after they do the downtown and business district, so it's later in the day, and there's less cars on the street because people have gone to work, so that the streets are free of cars. Maybe that doesn't work in Morro Bay. In a lot of cities, that's a typical street sweeping scenario.
Cars that are parked on the street in the residential communities, I think, for the most part, are second cars that just sit there. They're not commuter cars. They're just cars that are there. And I don't know if there's a way also maybe to street sweep in the morning before people go to work. I'm a little paranoid about street sweeping, and where I used to live back east, it was you got a parking ticket if you were parked on the street during street sweeping time, and they had a car with a loudspeaker on it that would drive through the street about two blocks ahead of the street sweeper, and it would announce in a loud voice, street sweeping, move your car quickly. And you would listen, and you'd move your car, or you'd get a ticket. And it was early in the morning when you were awakened by the loud horn. I don't know. Not that I want that. I just want the effectiveness of the street sweeping. If we're going to pay for it to not be, to actually be along the side of the street where it's needed.
This year, we'll also be working on a new contract for street sweeping. We've had the same vendor for quite some time, and we've been operating without a contract for quite some time also. There's some frustration with that vendor, so we're looking to go out to bid for new street sweeping. We may put that in as part of the bid that they need to come up with some sort of notification method. We'll give some thought to that and see if we can come up with an effective way to get the cars out of the street to do that street sweeping.
I'm curious what that costs a year, the street sweeping.
$72,000, $6,000 a month.
Wow.
Buys us typically once a month in the residential district and district areas, and twice a week in the commercial areas.
Has that ever been debated about the necessity of spending that kind of money for that service? I mean, or has it just been something that's been in place forever? And
I know that when it was reduced in the downtown area, the city did receive many complaints regarding the condition of the downtown streets not being swept on a twice-a-week basis.
Was that complaints from the business owners or were from
Majority were from,
customers?
I believe, were from business owners.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Richard, did you have any comments about the... All right. Jim? I really like the way it was laid out. I don't know if it was the requirements of the document itself, but it was seemed very clear to read through it. And then the one comment I had was I had a question about the various educational resources. And then I was just thinking, gosh, did they do it in Spanish? And then I caught in the back that some of your websites...
There's really no action required of this. We logged your comments, so we'll be looking at making any changes or clarifications. And then what we'll do is we will submit this to the regional board for their review and hopefully approval so we can get on with this year's projects.
Damaris, I'm sorry, when did you say those signs were going to be done?
I'm not exactly sure when they'll get done. We've got the proof of it now, so we're reviewing it, seeing if we want to make any changes. NEP's been given it also to see if they want to have any input on it, and then they'll be created and put up sometime by this next permit year. They'll be finished.
And I guess I have a question about the hot tubs. How does someone discharge their hot tub? What should someone do?
Well, let's see. You can dechlorinate your hot tub. Let me see what the what was that one?
The listing was for basically low threat discharges that we're not proposing to regulate at this point in time because the threat is so low. So once you've dechlorinated that water, it really doesn't pose a threat.
So just dechlorinate your hot tub first and then discharge the water.
Or discharge to sanitary sewer would be another, but not all hot tubs are, especially the older ones, are plumbed so that they can be effectively discharged to the sewer.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
You could water your garden once it's dechlorinated also. Would be.
Gray water.
Okay, moving on. Thank you for that. And we're on to old business was already taken care of. Future agenda items. We have a number of items here, but for the July meeting, Rob, is there anything prior? Usually the city has a prioritized item, and then the members, we... No, we're having a July meeting. July 20th. Yes, we are. Yes, we won't have a quorum, but we are going to have a meeting.
It may be the thing that we were going to bring back in July was our water billing, water conservation items. That may be better to have when you have a quorum here.
Is that going to be a voting issue? Because
I don't know that it'll be a voting issue, but it was.
Was that going to be the one with a presentation?
Yes.
Explaining?
Yeah, exactly.
So would we necessarily need a quorum for that?
Probably wouldn't need a quorum, but I know that most of the board members were interested in seeing that. If you did want to take a break in the summer, this might be a good meeting to do that in. I'm not saying that you have to do that, but I'll leave that to the discretion of the board.
It's my summertime, so I don't mind a break either. Well, we have a quorum here now, so we can. Do we have to vote on this, or we just say no?
I'd like to see a motion, you know, for when you want to meet, you know, to the next regular scheduled meeting, perhaps on August. I don't have my. Let me get a calendar here. if I can get one, if I can figure out a BlackBerry here. Oh, that's not it. And I need glasses probably to read. Oh, if somebody has paper, that'll be much.
We need a motion then to not have our July meeting and to meet again on August 18th.
So moved.
Was that satisfactory?
Yes.
Okay. And all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. So the next scheduled PWAB meeting will be August 18th. And hopefully we will have a quorum and we will be talking about water billing on that meeting. And then also, now's the time to come up with another agenda item that maybe would any of us would like to. Jenny, you have the main and San Jacinto intersection. That's really the only one. Would you really like to have that one on this next meeting?
Yes.
Short and sweet. So can we do that? And you're going to be developing a presentation for that?
Yes.
All right. Another yes. All right. So our future agenda items will be that water billing. And
I would like to have an update on what's happening at Quintana and South Bay intersection.
All right.
I will provide that update.
Great. All right. So that should do it for the June 16th version of PWAB. And so we will see...